second half of the first day's session, and I'm pleased to be joined by Rudy Dix. As we've heard, he's the head of the Project Management Office at the Presidency, where he supports the implementation of the Presidential Job Summit Framework Agreement, as well as the President's Youth Employment Initiative. He's also tasked with unblocking regulatory challenges that impact employment and economic growth. Welcome, Rudy.
Thanks, Samantha.
So in 2020, South Africa launched its 2050 Low Emissions Development Strategy, which outlines a commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. President Ramaphosa followed this up in November 2021 with a political declaration which established a partnership with the US, the UK, the EU, France, and Germany. And all members have committed to working towards creating a just transition to a low carbon economy. What brought this about, and why did it happen when it did?
Yeah, it's one of those things where the opportunity just kind of lands itself. But I think it's quite important to contextualize, because I think many people tend to misunderstand and think that the money was driving the policy, right? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that people were saying, well, okay, they've taken the money and now they've made those policy changes. And in fact, the policy changes have been long oncoming, supported by, of course, government, the formation, Deepak is here, the formation of the Presidential Climate Commission. And that commitment on a just transition has been quite an important policy thing. Now,
So they were late to the party?
They were late to the party, of course, yes. So part of the UNFCCC commitments around financing for development and financing for just transition, this is the commitment that we've kind of like packaged it out from. But the point was that we were able to put together quite a cohesive policy response, you know, and so of course revised NDC, National Determined Contributions, a just energy transition framework. One specifically also guiding in terms of our consultation with the PCC, and then a number of other policy responses that was important. So showing that level of ambition and commitment led to which we refer to them as the international partner group of countries, led to them saying, well, okay, you've given this kind of commitments. Can we fund part of your transition? Mm. And this, of course, led to a conversation that we've had with the international partner group during middle of 2021, and led, of course, to the political declaration that was concluded between ourselves and the five. Well, it was initially four. The EU came slightly late in, but they've agreed. Okay, well, fine. We'd also like to be part of it, and that's it. So it's quite important for us to put it in the context of, you know, we've done all the costing. We know what our transition is going to be. We know we're moving towards net zero. We know that we require just transition. That's an important part of our landscape. We know that we have to decommission in terms of our integrated resource plan. We know we have to look at mitigation. We know we have to look at many of these other areas. And, of course, these are important things that we've put into a process already. What has happened is that this of course, a small contribution, because, again, many figures are bandied around, right, that our transition over the next 15 to 25 years is going to cost us close to about 200 to 250 billion US dollars. So, in the context of 8.5 billion, that is fairly minute. It's a start, and I think this is important on the commitments that was made at COP on funding developmental countries and least developed countries' transitions. Right.
So on that, I mean, you mentioned the 8.5 billion US dollars, which was committed by this international partnership over the next 3 to 5 years. Initially, there was discussion about grants and concessional financing and, you know, looking at different mechanisms. Where are we now and on what's been agreed?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a, I can't disclose because you're still negotiating.
Come on. what direction is it heading in? Or what is the narrowed down options?
I think what the partners have indicated is a large component of it being concessional, right? So it's large. The large component is debt. Right, and there's a conversation. I'm a bit of a finance person, but I, you know, there's always a conversation around concessional and highly concessional. I don't quite know what it is, but I mean, these are some of the terms that are there. And you know, if you talk about policy-based loans and some of the concessionality around that, I think it's important that we're going to have to stretch the envelope a little bit about innovation, because you and I were talking about it. This is the first, right? And so, of course, if you're going into a first, it's about stretching the innovation and the imagination around what is possible. And this is the tricky thing in engaging with the international partner group, is trying to get them to say, well, your policy instruments that you've used, it's fine and well, but because this is very different, can we look at different innovative instruments that can be utilized to be able to fund some of this? So a large part of it is going to be through concessional borrowing. Some of it is policy-based loans. Other, for example, is through using sovereign lending rates. Others using private sector to invest. I mean, in an ideal situation, what you want is 8.5 billion outside that room in bags, right? And you'd like to bring them in and put them into your bank account.
I think we've stopped accepting money in bags after certain scandals happen in the country. So we're not going to do that.
In an ideal situation, you'd think of a pool of money somewhere, and you'd bags is probably the worst possible thing. But for illustration purposes, this is exactly what you wanted. It's financing around this is not as easy as that, of course, and so there are complexities to this. Ideally, we'd initially put in a single financing instrument. So if there's flow of funds that come into the sovereign, it comes through different parties, whether it's DFIs or whether it's, different funding instruments that are in their local, countries, and coming into a single facility that could be dispersed on the basis of project funding, kind of drawdown facility in a sense, if one simplifies it in that way. And that's not going to be the case, of course. So the risk about that is that they potentially a high level of transactional costs for the sovereign around it. So you have to manage that. And these are the questions and the issues that we still have to get through and negotiate, other than the cost of borrowing, of course, because that's the other thing. And then, of course, during negotiations, you push up a little bit of the aspects related to the grant component. You have to use different negotiating tactics to be able to do that. But I think we're fairly on a process where we can see what the 8.5 billion contains. We can see what could flow immediately. We have to get an agreement on the cost of that borrowing, if that's the case. The terms, of course, and the conditionalities in relation to that. But that's where we're at right now. That's all I can share. Sorry about that.
I think you've shared a lot. We'll take it. You've highlighted two things which I think are important to reinforce. The first one is obviously the country's preparedness ahead of this engagement with international partners. But the second part is also, and this is something that we've talked about, is having the technical experts and the right people in the negotiating room. This partnership was announced just before COP26, and I'm curious, how did it impact the way that South Africa went into that summit, and also some of the results that came afterwards?
The one thing that South Africa's good at is negotiations, right?
Okay.
No matter what, right?
I mean, you have to say that, though.
We have to. And I was lucky to be, I was fortunate to be part the lead for government on the negotiating team. In that, and a lot of experts outside providing advice and guidance. So when we locked in the political declaration, it's important. So for us, it's always important to go back to that political declaration, because it's a one of a kind. It's quite, if I look at it again and again, and we read it regularly, it's quite progressive. It's important that we maintain the essence of that agreement as it is. Of course, you'd find potentially partners wanting to backtrack and wanting to look at it very differently. I said, no, that's not what we meant. It's what's written there. That's the critical thing. So, for us, the next step was trying to get in sufficient technical expertise in that. But more critical was that we needed to ensure that the National Treasury is at the center of this, because it's their domain, it's their expertise. And, of course, asset and liability management has been an important part. Dr. Duncan Peterson, who is the head of asset and liability management at National Treasury, has been part of it. But getting people like Daniel, for example, who is a finance expert and former governor of the Reserve Bank, former CEO of EPSA, getting a whole lot of different other experts, Joanne Yawich, for example, which we'd agreed with the IPG to head the secretariat, who is an absolute expert understanding the energy and just transition component, and a whole lot of different people. Because I think that's the critical thing. We're kind of like moving into a space and we're watching each other, and we're trying to figure out like what someone else is saying and whether we're going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. There's no recipe for this thing, right? I mean, that's the thing. You kind of like have to manage risk as you go along I mean, there's a lot of risk involved in this. Because, and let me just say, I mean, if we get it wrong, to be frank, it's dead in the water, right? No one else would use this formula.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get it right, there are potential for this growing quite significantly in many of the high carbon emitting countries. Indonesia is another example that I think they're looking at. Vietnam, for example, Mexico, the Indians, for example. So these are all important conversations, getting the right technical expertise in the room, getting the right people to do the specific exercises that is required. And more importantly, I mean, you recall this 3 to 5 years is about energy transitioning, and that's the issues around coal and decommissioning. It's about electric vehicles, and it's about green hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So getting the right experts. So think about it, right? Electric vehicles, we have quite an advanced ICE kind of sector, internal combustion engine sector, which exports close to between 500 and 800,000 vehicles. I mean, we roughly get about 200 to 210 billion in revenue exports. And of course, if you're looking at, carbon adjustments that are going to take place in the EU, it's likely, the EU is, of course, mm-hmm. is our biggest export sector.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely to hit us quite hard. So we have to think quite fast. And literally, if it's done in 2035, you have to think now because there are cycles that both Mercedes-Benz, I mean, all of them think through, and their cycles are every 7 years. And for example, cycles for many of these OEMs end in the next 3 to 4 years. So you have to think really, really fast around those kind of stuff. So quite critical for us to get experts in to be able to think through that. And we're sometimes slow with policy, and that's the thing, right? I mean, I should admit that, but implementing is not our best also. So we've got to do this quite quickly, bring in the right expertise. The solid thing about this also in the expertise environment is that we've able to develop a very strong partnership with the private sector on this.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring in private sector expertise. We've been talking to financial institutions. We've been talking to different experts in those particular fields and bringing them all together, including Eskom, of course, because that's right. going to be an important conversation to have.
I think you've led me right into the next question, okay. which is, we can't talk about just transition without also touching a little bit on Eskom and the state of the country's energy supply. The low emissions development strategy aims to reach net zero by 2050, but it also states that South Africa will still be using coal by 2050. We know that Kusile and Medupi will start coming online in about 2030, I think has been...
No, they're already both online.
Okay, right? So but they'll come online with, 1,000 megawatts, 1,000 extra.
Potentially, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In actual fact, both Medupi is kind of like, I mean, they've achieved commercial operation a few years ago. And there's the one unit that was destroyed, right? And that's been built, that's been rebuilt completely, and that will come online next year. Kusile still has two units that will come into commercial operation next year in June and October. Medupi already, if you look at the EIF, is churning out at about 85 to 90%, energy availability factor. Both of them would respectively run up until the late 50s, 2050, and early 60s, right? So coal is going to be part of our mix.
Mm-hmm.
It's the decision about what we do to grow our economy and what energy mix will be there
mm-hmm.
as an add-on, right? And
right.
I think this is an important part of the conversations. And the other conversation is also, we have an integrated resource plan that determines how we decommission. And of course, if one looks at that plan, it's going to be updated, of course. And I think it has to be updated. For two reasons. One, that if we committed to this package, we would have to build a lot more renewables, quite mm-hmm. significantly so, both through the public procurement process, Eskom itself investing a lot more, and then private sector generation that we've opened up since March last year, which is through the embedded generation space. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's about 6,000 megawatts of potential private sector generation. And this is not in a public process. This is, a developer providing and dispatching to an end user or many end users to be able to do that. So a combination of all of these things, but coal will still be there. Gas will also be an important part of that transition. We've made it fairly clear to the IPG, of course, they're going to tell us, well, you can't use our money for gas because we don't want you to use it for any hydrocarbons. That's fine. We'll find funding elsewhere if that's the case, In the second reason, of course, you would have to think through this quite carefully, is the geopolitical developments that are taking place. Mm-hmm. Right? And for us, it's very important because the announcement that the president had made around the energy plan is that the key and the most important aspect of the energy plan is energy security. So if it means that we have to look at some of those particular commitments and look at it again, and I'm raising this as part of a debate. We've mm-hmm. not taken a decision as government yet. We're going to have to look at those commitments in terms of the kind of geopolitical challenges that are there and ensuring that we do get energy security. We want to end load shedding, of course. That's going to be important for us. We want to ensure that we invest more renewables onto the, we bring more renewables onto the grid so that we keep track with our growth or ensure that we able to achieve the kind of growth and investment that we require.
You touched on policy and you know, sometimes how that can be a complex process and not entirely as smooth as you would like. There has been some criticism about the rollout of the renewable energy policy and the slightly stilted approach to it. And obviously getting this right is a key component of realizing net zero by 2050. What do you have to say about
that?
Yeah,
I mean,
that?
It's been a crazy roller coaster ride, right? I mean, we developed one of the best IPP programs globally, leading in 2010, where, but we know, 1, 2, 3, and suddenly we stall, right? Because there's a whole policy contestation as to the role of renewables versus coal, a bit of a debate that I think is something that shouldn't be happening, because coal will still be a large component of our energy mix for foreseeable future. I think the president, when he came in, I know the president, when he came in, took a clear policy decision, right, that government will continue the REIPPPP program, the Renewable Independent Power Producer program. And of course, we got to 4 and we were able to bring all of 4 onto the grid, and I think that's important, 2,600 of those megawatts. We were able to issue the RFP for bid window 5 and, mm-hmm. of course, bid window 6 because we doubled the amount of megawatts from 2,600 to 5,200. We've extended the bidding period up until the middle of September. So, there's been significant implication. Of course, one of the biggest implications, it completely decimated our local industrial development. Mm-hmm. Because we spent such a lot of time from 2010 to bring on board local capacity, local manufacturing capacity, both for wind and for PV solar. And of course, when they stalled, what happens is that you had no continuous orders. And of course, many of these firms had closed down. So you literally have to start from scratch in building through local capacity again, you know. And of course, what that means as you generally work in an investment environment, these are risky investments. I mean, people consider, no, will they change their policy again in about mm-hmm. 5 years' time? Is it consistent? And these kind of create a bit of insecurity. So I think there's a bit of a trust issue that we need to develop with private generators, both in the IPP program, I think, and the embedded generation program. But we're back on track, and we hope to keep that going for a long time. I mean, part of the deal of the 8.5 is trying to solidify that and support the development of a capable, cheap, reliable, renewable energy sector where it has local manufacturing capacity.
Thank you. You touched on and you mentioned the strength of South Africa's automotive industry. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts as to where do you see the intersection between just energy transition, automotive industry growth, and South Africa's mining sector. I know I'm throwing a bunch of different ideas at you, but I'm curious because all of those, it's all interrelated and you know, it's part of a bigger thing, and also partly also has an impact on job creation and obviously economic growth in the country. So thinking ahead and looking over the next sort of 10 to 20 or 30 years, how do you see those different industries and those different things playing together?
Absolutely. I mean, if one just focuses on the automotive, like I said, I mean, it's the one of the largest manufacturing export industries, export earning industries. So we get about 200 billion, then most of that comes from the EU, right? We're trying to expand our market in China also, and some of them also come from the US. Now, if the EU takes a decision, right, and sorry, so let's just give a sense of that. So we have most of the big OEMs, we run We run an incentive program that pumps billions of rands into keeping the industry here. We have about 110,000 to 115,000 people working directly in the sector. We've developed an advanced automotive supply chain, and that's been phenomenal because of the incentive programs that we built, that we are able to compete globally even to get into the OEM supply chains, right? And if the EU takes a decision, right, that it would no longer bring in internal combustion engines into the EU from 2035, then we're in trouble if we don't do that. It means that the sector would be decimated. So we'd have to think quite fast on our feet, engaging with OEMs, engaging with, I mean, government, of course, has to take the policy decision. It doesn't necessarily mean that ICE vehicles would not find market space, right? So you'd have to think of ICE vehicles potentially in our engagements with Toyota, for example. They want to develop a strategy that looks at Africa, okay, at the region, because certainly in their view, they don't think that the ability for electric vehicles to take off in the rest of Africa is going to happen as fast as it may happen in South Africa. And then, of course, local demand. Will there be sufficient local demand? What sort of infrastructure would we require? So these are all complex things that, if you think about it, and many of you think of buying an electric vehicle, you look at the price and you look at the cost of it. And I know many people say it's because of our auto vehicle program that we run that's prohibitively expensive in importing, for example, electric vehicles. Those are all issues that we need to think through. So there is a complexity about it. We'd want to see the continuation and us, you know, leading and being ahead. The mining sector will continue to grow. I think that's important. I mean, South Africa is, quite rich in different, minerals and commodity groups, right? I mean, literally right now, we'd still continue to export coal, and it will be exported for the foreseeable future. The same with iron and the same with others. So it's quite critical. So in our conversations around the just transition in coal mining, I mean, we've made this quite important. The PCC is going to play a fundamental role because it's important that we do take stakeholders along. We do take unions along. We do take community organizations along. We need to understand what it means if we decommission, if we take a decision around Komati. Right? So we're decommissioning Komati. What does it mean for the workers that are working at the power station? What does it mean for the communities that are dependent on that power station? What does it mean for the supply chain that goes into that power station? What does it mean for the revenue of that municipality and the revenue for government, for example? And so all these interlinkages and different interest groups are, of course, impacted. So you have to manage this in a manner that is quite clear. Now, we don't do well. I mean, I must be honest. We don't do well economically when you talk about transitions, and particularly when it impacts on the poor and workers. They tend to be left to their own devices. I think we've got a real opportunity here to utilize a just energy transition for a new form of growth that's sustainable, and we need to be inclusive in developing that. So part of the questions that we have to ask in Mpumalanga, since 15 of the power stations that are there, what sort of economy do you want to build post-coal? And it's not an economy that we build after decommissioning. It's an economy that you start building right now. Yeah. What sort of value chains? Are we going to invest in manufacturing capacity? Are we going to look at other sectors? And that's the nub of the kind of issues that we need to do. And when we talk about an investment plan for the international partner group as part of the 8.5, part of that is starting to answer those particular questions. But again, it's about trust building. We're going to have to talk to communities, municipalities, to the provincial government, to union members, so that they can understand that we're simply just not closing down and there's no alternative. Because we can't afford no alternative. Mm-hmm. You know, unemployment rate is as it is right now. Poverty is as it is right now. We can't create more depressed economic communities, right, and more young people and workers out of work. It does require for us to have a much more concerted effort and to target interventions where the impact will be felt much more.
Final question. It's 2049. We are 1 year away from seeing the end of the LED strategy being realized. I'm not going to talk about it from a national level, but focusing maybe just on Mpumalanga, what does success and shared value look like when we're looking at that particular province and particularly the coal communities in 2049?
You still have Kusile Modupi operating, right?
Yeah.
You still have Kusile Modupi operating. you'll see the vast majority of workers who were in coal power fire stations earning, getting into retirement, young people getting into new skill sets. For Kanye's here, we're going to have to look at the tech and digital sectors that would be developed about that. We're looking at the burgeoning tourism sector. We have a beautiful SEZ there that manufactures PV parts and components, not only for South Africa, but for the rest of the continent, linked into value chains. We have supply chains that are well-developed and an employment rate, an unemployment rate of about 5%. That's what we need to have.
Okay, we know what we're aiming for.
That's what we need to have. And yes, that's the most important part because they remind us constantly. I've been traveling a lot to Mpumalanga. Mpumalanga will remain the province of the rising sun.
Fantastic. Right? Thank you so much, Rudy.
So as ambitious as that is, I think we need to make sure that we get to that.
Yeah. Thank you. We look forward to it.
Thanks, Arisa.
Thanks so much for your time.
Okay. Thank you.